Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Anant Shankar Osorio, says the 2008 economic crisis was a golden opportunity for those of us trying to cement a new way of thinking about the economy. We had demand for our product dumped in our laps. At last, the public was convinced that the old ways of doing things were not working. Americans were ready to question their assumptions, poised to consider an alternative view. An advertiser's dream, we finally had an audience wanting us to pitch our new good. But instead of rejoining and putting together a prototype for the public, we got bogged down in the specifics. In other words, there was failure. 4 years later, the buzzwords of the day are deficit reduction and fiscal cliff. Rather than talking about alternatives to capitalism or continuing the conversation about co-ops and community banks, the conversation of the day focuses on cutting Social Security and raising the retirement age. What explains this? How did we get here? On today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by speaking with Anant Shankar Osorio about her new book, Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. Anant runs ASO Communications. She's conducted multiple studies on how people reason about the economy, inequality, race, and health. And she joins us here in studio. Hi, Anant. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
So to get right to the crux of your argument, you're basically saying that progressives have failed, right?
I'm saying that there is a big part of the current conditions that we are facing that we actually need to look inward and take responsibility for. Yes.
There was a major opportunity during the economic crisis of 2008 to drastically change the conversation. And I remember a lot of it did change. I mean, even on places like CNBC, they were questioning capitalism. They were talking about growing inequality.
Sure. And, you know, it's not that we haven't had any change at all. It's not that we haven't had a burgeoning sort of awareness of inequality, which is certainly a good thing. And, you know, we could stand way more of that. We had Occupy Wall Street with the introduction of the concept of the 99% and the 1% and so on. And those were, you know, messaging and communication and cognitive leaps forward in terms of our understanding of the economy. But still, we have these default dominant notions that have us believe that it is our job to sacrifice and work for the economy as if it were some sort of living, breathing thing.
Elaborate on that.
Sure. So, you know, not a day goes by that we don't hear that we can't pass X policy. You know, we can't have more whatever social welfare program is being debated because the economy won't like it, or the markets will get skittish, or the dollar will fall. And it's as if our language would have us believe these are actual entities. This is like your crotchety uncle or your, you know, unbiteable teenage daughter. And the fact of the matter is that the words that we use actually shape our perceptions. And we know that from decades of study and experiments that we've conducted. And the ways that we talk about the economy in this case actually shape what people perceive to be true, their judgments of it, and ultimately their desires for public policy.
And you write that 2008 was the best time to do this because, according to Pew Research, 70% of Americans were following economic news. This is a massive number of people.
Yes, especially relative to how that number usually sits. And so suddenly we had people actually self-initiating, huh, what's going on here? Something is not right. The system that I have been sold my whole life subliminally about, if I just work hard and play by the rules, one of my least favorite phrases that we just can't seem to get away from, then everything will work out for me. But suddenly all of those questions, all of those things, those assumptions came into question for people. And that was the moment. That was when we have, you know, what an advertiser would call demand for our brand created, which is, you know, a very, very difficult thing to do. And so it had come to us. And had we had at that point an alternative storyline about this is what the economy is, this is how it functions, when you do this to it, this occurs, when you do that to it, you can expect this result. But instead of having that underlying story, What we did was what we always do, which is a litany of very well-placed, very well-researched, very correct critiques of what was wrong, somewhat less coherent but still existing notion of how it ought to be, but no explanation for what I like to call the how. How do we get from where we are to where we would like to be? What is the mechanism by which the economy functions? And, you know, trickle down is a complete and total fantasy, right? But it's a storyline. Mm-hmm. It has heroes. It has villains. It has a beginning. It has a middle. It has an end. Things occur. And for folks like me and who believe in Keynesian economic theory, and, you know, it's well vetted and well proven. We have the facts on our side. They have a well-known liberal bias, as we've heard. That is a counterintuitive idea. The idea that in times of greatest sort of financial hardship, the government actually needs to spend more, that is difficult to wrap your brain around. And because we don't have an easy storyline like Trickle Down, that, again, wall of fiction is a coherent story, it becomes very, very difficult for people to buy our policy prescriptions.
How do you talk about 2008 and what really happened there? Because I remember a lot of alternative outlets up until that point hadn't really been writing about the economy. And it sort of hit them in the face. And they realized, oh, we need to really focus on this and find out what happened and figure out where we're going to go from here. So were you hopeful at all in 2008? When these issues actually did get a lot of play?
I was hugely hopeful, and that actually is when I began this exploration of the underlying metaphors that we use to talk about the economy, based on the hypothesis that by understanding the range of ways people make sense of the economy, and I'm talking about non-economists, I'm talking about regular folks, we could figure out which one was most accurate and which one sort of highlighted the set of things about the economy that we need people to understand. Most importantly, that the economy is not a god. The economy is not your crotchety uncle. The economy is not healthy or unhealthy. You know, phrases like recovery bill, all of this sort of puts forth the notion that the economy is somehow akin to a person. When in fact we know that the economy is nothing more than a convention. It's the way that we measure the things that we do and the things that we buy and the things we produce and consume and so forth. And it has no existence outside of the workers and consumers and investors, the people, right? And so the economy does not suffer. In fact, people suffer. Mm. But because we continue to speak in these terms, it becomes logical for us to really believe, oh, we actually can't do that thing. It's going to hurt the economy. So, yes, I was hopeful in 2008. I was hopeful because I saw an uptick in the consumption of economic news, as you mentioned. I was hopeful because I saw sort of more mainstream questioning of economic paradigms. But the truth of the matter is that if you look at the difference between 2008 and 2010, and not just in the election, but in terms of news coverage, you know, you got to give conservatives credit where credit is due. Mm-hmm. They managed to take reality, take people's lived experience, which generally is sort of the strongest indicator that people have of what ought to be done and how things ought to be, and they managed to turn that around and say, actually, what happened here was Fannie and Freddie. Actually, what happened here was the government. Actually, what happened, right? They once again, knowing narrative structure, knowing that a narrative needs a hero, needs a villain, needs a beginning, middle, and end, needs a quest, they found a villain, and that villain was called government. And we don't do that.
And when you think about where we are today, as I mentioned, fiscal cliff, debt, Social Security raising the retirement age, this is the conversation we're having.
It is. And we are all we continue to be sort of in a race with our opponents to see who can stroke the deficit mania more.
And now, you closely follow cable news footage. You have compiled comments from politicians for years. How do they do it so successfully?
So there are many things that they do very, very successfully. And by they, I assume you mean...
Well, conservatives, but not just conservatives, because you talk about Bill Clinton using a lot of this same language in the 90s. Mm-hmm. How are they able to completely shift the conversation and use these buzzwords to penetrate the national dialogue?
So a few ways. First of all, I'm sure you've explored the idea that they have incredible message discipline, and that is partly because they have a well-funded infrastructure of, you know, organizations like Heritage and Hoover and American Enterprise Institute that since the Barry Goldwater debacle have been funded to sort of produce ideas and to create an echo chamber. So one of the things is that literally they just spend money in this space and they get it right for themselves. Number two, they are much more sort of wired to believe in hierarchy. And so they will follow right. a centralized message, whereas progressives just, you know, won't.
So you have Frank Luntz, for example, the guy who decided, I think, to use climate change instead of global warming,
right.
which most people use now.
Right.
He's a master at this language.
Right. Death tax.
He'll send out the marching orders, and they will take them.
Yes.
Hardly any questions asked.
Yes.
Is there anything like that for Democrats?
There are attempts. There are things like Media Matters produces something called Message Matters, which tends to be really, really great. There are different organizations, but, I mean, there are so many answers to this question. Structurally, on the left, and I know because I consult in and out of organizations across the board, there is a disincentive to follow marching orders. Because the way that our institutions are funded, and I don't know if you want to go into this level of detail, but the way that our institutions are funded, it creates what I like to call not invented here syndrome. Because you get money from donors and from large philanthropic organizations for recreating the wheel. So Planned Parenthood needs to have its thing that it's going to say about long-acting contraceptives, and now needs to have its thing, and NARAL needs to have its thing, and so on and so forth. And I'm just using that as one example.
Right.
I could go down the line with the environment. I could go down the line with taxes, et cetera. And so if you're following what someone else does, then the funder is saying, what are you doing? Where is your program? Where is your communication strategy? Where is your... And so there is an incentive to... You know, everybody have their own thing. Whereas on the right, they literally just pay their people to exist.
Mm.
So that's one thing. The other thing is that, and this is really, you know, a lot of what I explore in the book, because they have what I call metaphor discipline, because they have a sense of which overarching concept they need to highlight about the economy, this one that insists that it's an organic entity that is God-made and not person-made, it's much easier to have message discipline when you have metaphor discipline, because you don't actually need to repeat verbatim talking points. You can actually say what you want to about regulation or about the EPA or about taxation as long as it's situated within this body metaphor.
You make another really interesting point that if language does not reflect that the economic crisis was human-made, it follows that it cannot be human unmade either, which plays into the shrugging no-fault stance of mostly conservatives.
Yes. And part of the biggest, you know, problem that we have, I like to joke that I could spend every day, every moment of every one of my days just rewriting progressive websites out of the passive voice and be completely occupied and not be able to do any language analysis. We are so loath to name villains that constructions that we don't even register as passive voice. I will give you my favorite example. People lost their homes. People lose keys. They lose wallets, cell phones. If you're me, you lose all those things probably on a weekly basis. I have never managed to misplace my house. Never, ever. I always know where my house is. It is not true that people lose homes. Other people take them. And when we use these passivized constructions, same thing with the unemployment rate rose, as if it were yeast and we added water. That's not the case.
So let's stay with the people have lost their homes. Millions of people across this country have lost their homes.
Right.
That's a lead for a news report, right?
Or daily.
Daily. Or politicians say that. What would you say?
I would say, Jamie Dimon took your house. I would say, you know, whoever actually is responsible. And if you know a particular name, and an interesting thing, for the incredible folks who are working in institutions like the New Bottom Line or Occupy Our Homes, these organizations or Lane down in the southern part of the state, these organizations that are, you know, working on the front lines of this, they have found that in their direct actions to try to help people save their homes, when they name an actual individual, a loan officer or the bank manager or the person responsible, they actually get an uptick in participation and interest versus just even naming the bank as an institution. It's funny how often we give in to the corporations are people thing. And we actually say, corporations are doing this, corporations are doing that.
Well, in this case, aren't the Democrats also to blame? Because can you imagine President Obama, say, Jamie Dimon took your home, when he's taking a ton of money from Jamie Dimon?
Absolutely.
Who's the JP Morgan CEO?
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. So part of the other thing that is going on here, and this is also an answer to your earlier question, is, of course, President Obama can't say that. And of course, these problems are multifold and, you know, probably rooted not actually in the economy, but rather in the completely and totally bought and paid for government that we have and in, you know, the lack of any kind of campaign finance system and so on, that makes it so that the people who are our purported leaders can't actually speak out on our behalf. I get that. But the other thing that the right is really, really sophisticated about and the left is not, this is sometimes referenced as the we're playing checkers while they're playing chess, is that we almost never have a left flank. We consider it our responsibility, especially, for example, during this election season at the end of 2011, to always have Obama's back, right? Mm. I actually don't think it's helpful at all for Obama, for us to, quote unquote, have his back. If you look at what the right does, and Social Security, which you brought up earlier, is a perfect example. When they first brought up the idea of privatizing Social Security, which they then got Frank Luntz to tell them they shouldn't call it privatized, they should call it personal savings accounts, right? Personalized, that sounds much nicer. It polled abysmally. They're not stupid. They do public opinion testing like we do. But what happens? They do public opinion testing. Privatizing Social Security polls abysmally. So what do? They introduce it anyway. That's not what we do. When something polls abysmally, we would never dare utter it because that's not how we work. So they introduce it anyway. And then they introduce it again. And then they introduce it again. And then they introduce it again. And so now in the public discourse, intelligent friends of mine, well-read, news-consuming, progressive friends of mine say to me, hey, did you know that Social Security is insolvent? And I say, where did you hear that nonsense? That is nonsense. That is not true. But what they do is they actually shift the entire tenor of the conversation to the right. When they have their legitimate right people, when they have their Todd Akins, it's true, he was sacrificed on the altar of elections, but the Todd Akins of their party is what makes the other dude who only opposes abortion in every single case except to save the mother's life, or the other dude who opposes in every case except for rapes or incest. Those people become enlightened. Those people are Alan Alda. Those people are like, you know, paragons of liberal virtue. They shift the entire conversation.
We're speaking with Anat Shankar Osorio. She is out with a new book, Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. She says progressives had a perfect opportunity to shape a new way of thinking after the 2008 economic crisis. So where are we 4 years later? Where we're focused on fiscal cliffs, austerity, debt, Social Security, raising the retirement age, why? Anat spent 3 years studying all of this, tracking and cataloging economic writing and speeches from across the political spectrum, looking at how economists, politicians, and commentators think about the economy. She also looked at how the public thinks about the economy, and we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. So what are your thoughts? Because every Tuesday we do Agenda for a New Economy. We talk about these issues. And in our meeting yesterday, I said, yeah, we talked about co-ops. We talked about local banks. We talked about alternatives to capitalism. For a good 2 years there was a healthy dialogue about that. And I feel like it just sort of disappeared in many circles, not all, but most. So what are your thoughts on how the conversation has shifted since 2008? And how did we get to where we are today? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What issues do you want to raise when it comes to the economy, and how can we really bring these issues? Email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm so glad this woman wrote this book. Congratulations. You know, my point has always been that the GDP needs to begin to reflect reality. if a woman's if a wife's services are taken away from a family, insurance companies now have to pay $100,000 a year to replace her work. And unpaid women's work is the point. So until the GDP begins to reflect unpaid women's work, it's only going to be talking about part of the economy. As a matter of fact, when KPFA's Larry Bensky retired, I sent him the book, If Women Counted, by Marilyn Waring. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts on that book.
Thank you so much, Katie, and thanks for the congratulations. Yeah, that's a beautiful book, and it's a really, really important one. It comes out of sort of a scholarship. Kirsten Luker at Berkeley is another sort of leading light. The Second Shift, Arlie Hochschild, is also... I couldn't agree more. And in fact, I would go even farther with sort of our GDP worship, and this isn't a gendered issue per se, but if I walk up and down the street right now and smash all the car windows, then GDP will go up. Because those folks, those car owners, those poor, innocent people who happen, don't worry, I'm not going to do it. They have to go and get those cars repaired. And that costs money and services and so on. And so our estimation of what good is, because every time you hear the GDP grew, the GDP this, the GDP that, that's meant to be our understanding for something good happened, right? And I totally take your point about women's work and home care not being valuated, and that is ridiculous and appalling. But at an even larger vantage point, the mere notion that unchecked growth, the idea that me ruining a bunch of people's cars figures in mathematically as a good, just goes to show you how deep our misunderstanding is of what role the economy should play in our society.
Because you do point out these ideas are always repeated. Growth must be infinite. GDP is the valid measure of success. Conservation takes a back seat. Serious inequality is natural, and regulations are at best the lesser of evils.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the paradigm that we've accepted, and now we're arguing about the details. And by we, I don't mean, you know, surely your listeners, surely you, Rose, don't accept that. I don't accept that. But as far as kind of a dominant cultural framework, you know, I referenced earlier the phrase work hard and play by the rules. Even the so-called, you know, communist front group, and I say that lovingly because I have nothing but respect and admiration for Van Jones, so I don't really mean that, but Rebuild the Dream, you know, that was in their opening manifesto. That's a Clinton line. Arnold Schwarzenegger used that line. Geraldine Ferraro used that line. I mean, that is like your calling card that I'm like nice and cuddly and reasonable.
I'm glad you brought this up, because work hard and play by the rules. I think even Obama says this.
Hillary Clinton
says this.
She does.
So just take the first part of it. We have about a minute before we go to break.
So
work hard.
Work hard.
What's wrong with that?
In America, guess what? We do work hard. We work more than pretty much anyone else in the industrialized world. We are one of the only countries on earth with no paid sick leave. We are one of three countries in the entire world with no paid family medical leave. We used to share that distinction with Australia, but Australia managed to right itself a long time ago. And so, you know, what Afghanistan and Haiti and Ghana have figured out, we are still struggling with.
Well, hold that thought. We're gonna take a quick break. We're speaking with Anat Shenker Osorio about her book, Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. She says the conversation needs to shift drastically. The question is how. We'll be back after this.
Public Radio KALW, San Francisco. Every Tuesday, the Your Call team sends out weekly email newsletters. Helps keep us up on what's coming in future programs. Also gives resources to let you learn more and to get involved. You can subscribe today, and then when you do, you'll know what's coming up, and you can submit your questions and comments even before shows go to the air. It's free and easy to sign up. Just go to yourcallradio.org and click on the link that says email newsletter. We also invite you to participate in today's show by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send an email, question or comment to feedback at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation with former KALW reporter Nathaniel Johnson. He is out with a new book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest, to discover if the natural approach to diet, childbirth, healing, and the environment really keeps us healthier and happier. He says some are drawn to natural solutions while others rally around high-tech development. So which way have you gone and have you been able to find a happy medium? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are speaking with Anat Shenker Osorio about her new book, Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. She says that after the 2008 financial crisis, those of us who really didn't like where things were heading had a great opportunity to drastically change the conversation, and we failed. So why did this happen? What do you remember about 2008? And here we are, 4 years later, talking about debt, deficits, fiscal cliffs, retirement, raising the retirement age, and Social Security. How did we get here? What will it take to really talk about the real issues as we see poverty increasing, homelessness increasing, inequality increasing? What are your thoughts? We've got full lines right now, but we'll have a line open in just a couple minutes. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, better yet, so everyone else can see it. Anat runs ASO Communications. She's conducted multiple studies on how people reason about the economy, inequality, race, and health. And she has done work for the ACLU, Berkeley Media Studies Group, and the Center for Reproductive Rights, to name a few. She closely follows these issues. Before the break, we were talking about the phrase that everyone from conservatives to Bill Clinton to Van Jones has used, and that is,
work hard and play by the rules.
We hear this constantly.
Yes.
We hear this in speeches constantly. So you talked about the work hard part, the fact that we work more than most industrialized countries. We don't have paid time off for moms. And the list is very long.
Yeah. And in fact, one could argue, and there is a lot of evidence to suggest, that we actually are in this jobless, I don't like the word unemployed, because unemployed suggests unmotivated, uncaring, unworthy. I like to say jobless, which I realize is a different economic category, but never mind. So the reason that we have the jobless problem that we do is because we kind of worked ourselves out of a job. Americans have been so super productive over the last 40 years, and yet the gains to that productivity have been concentrated among what I like to call the luckiest few. We don't like to call them the top, because in English, one of our central metaphors is that good is up. And so every time we talk about the top 1% or the top X percent and the bottom, what we are actually doing is reinforcing a moral equivalency. We are saying that if you are wealthier, you are actually better. Mm-hmm. And that is not the case. So we have worked ourselves to this place where productivity is so incredibly high that if you can accomplish the same tasks in fewer person hours, then you can hire fewer people. And so the notion that we are going to get ourselves out of this situation by working harder is just mathematically false. I'm not even talking conceptually. And in fact, some of the most interesting proposals from our leading light economists would have us, and I'm going to shock you here, working less. Mandated 35-hour work weeks, work sharing, things to distribute the amount of work that there currently is among more people so that we can actually tackle the real issues, which are not how large our GDP is going to be and how many windows I can smash when I get out of the studio, but how we are actually going to have an economy that serves the people of this nation and no longer have the people of this nation serving this economy.
And then the other part of that sentence
is play by the rules. So play by the rules. The problem with that construction is that it's a tacit acknowledgement that the rules work. And even though the way that that sentence is used, certainly by folks like Rebuild the Dream, by like Van and even Clinton, is to say that we need to create the rules. We need to make sure the rules accomplish this thing. Still, it says that the onus is on the individual. It is an up by your bootstraps, do as you're told, make it work for yourself. You're on your own. As long as you're keeping your nose clean, keeping your head down and working harder, then any observed inequity is actually the fault lies with you. And that is just patently false, and it's not useful. That point of view has plenty of airtime. Even for those of you who sort of have some sort of anchor in that point of view. And for example, you know, I say this all the time with my clients. There are those who actually are concerned about the deficit. And I say to them, great, that's your economic vantage point. That's fine. Trust me, the deficit has enough airtime. It has more than enough people speaking on its behalf. Even if that is your concern, you still need not bring that up at every turn, because what isn't getting reported, what isn't getting noticed is real people, and they're the ones who are unhealthy and suffering.
Well, we have full lines from a lot of real people who'd like to jump in on this conversation. So let's go through a few, and then we'll get a response from Anat. Let's hear from Lee in San Francisco. Hi, Lee.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. George Lakoff addressed many of these framing issues more than 20 years ago and has been writing about them, has written about them very articulately and simply. And yet we continue to frame these discussions, as you say, in very false terms. This notion of working hard is absolutely transparently propaganda, as is fiscal cliff, which was not even correct in terms of what was actually going on. So I'm hearing a lot of critique. I read tons of critique. I understand it. I know it. I don't believe it. But I want to know, what constructively can we do now to turn this around and make the discussion relevant to the needs that we experience as workers and as a society?
Excellent question. Thank you so much for asking it, Lee. Yeah, and I know and admire George. I know him personally and studied with him. So to have his name come up in connection with mine is obviously a great treat. Concretely, the first thing at the metaphor level, we have a metaphor for the economy that suggests human agency and that suggests human construction. And you can hear that in language like it's on the right track, it's on the wrong track, it's veering out of control. We talk about accelerating job losses. When we speak about the economy in the terms that we normally use for a vehicle, which you could probably tell from that language, what we are suggesting unconsciously to people is that it requires a driver. Because, you know, Google cars aside, our default assumption about vehicles is that they require continuous external supervision. So at a minimum, because we need people to understand that the economy requires government oversight, otherwise none of our progressive policy solutions from regulation to setting levels of taxation make any sense. Number one, my suggestion is that we begin to use a more helpful metaphor. Number two, we need to wean ourselves off of the passive voice and get more comfortable being aggressive and naming names. Number three, and this is actually, I mean, this is usually astounding to people, but when you look at the way that public opinion research is done on the left, and, you know, I'm deep in it because that's what I do every day. If you look at dial testing is if you watch the debates on CNN and you watch the lines going across your screen, those are dials. So people are listening to the message. They're moving their hand back and forth. The way that we have always scored a dial on the left is by looking for what I call three high lines. So we divide people into groups: base, people who are with us; persuadables, people who go either way; and opposition, people who, no matter what you say, you could speak for 14 days without breathing, they will never, ever, ever support progressive taxation or whatever it is the issue you're dialing on. So we look for the place in the message where we get three high lines. Dial is scored from 0 to 100, 50 is neutral, 75 is your magic mark. So what could you possibly say if your metric is, I want three high lines? I can tell you exactly. In immigration, you can say tough, fair, and practical. We need comprehensive immigration reform that's tough, fair, and practical. In abortion, you can say safe, legal, and rare. And with the economy, you can say, of course, we should be concerned about the deficit, even as we blah, blah, blah. But you never actually fill in that blah, blah, blah. Or, of course, we should be concerned about the deficit. The way to tackle the deficit is to raise revenue, right? Because that is the only thing, by definition, you can say that everyone is going to feel kind of sort of comfortable with. That is not the way the right scores a dial. What Frank Luntz looks for in a dial is two high lines. So his base, conservatives, in the stratosphere, clearing 75, hopefully in the 80s and 90s. Persuadables at least hitting that 75 mark. And the opposition, meaning progressives, tanking. So he looks for a message that engages the base, persuades the middle, and alienates the opposition. So a big part of the reason why Lakoff's critique and Drew Weston's critique has not penetrated in the way that it should is actually mathematical. We have actually been looking for the wrong thing when we define a winning message. And that is something that has become my soapbox. It is something that I say to every Democratic and progressive pollster, and it is something that I'm working to change.
So what is the solution here?
The solution is that we need to get comfortable finding messages that engage...
Who's we? Yeah.
Well, at a minimum, first, it needs to be progressives. It needs to be organizations that self-describe and feel completely comfortable in a space calling themselves liberal or progressive. So I'm not talking about the Democratic Party, right? Because insofar as we represent sort of a wing of that party or a mindset that is within that party, which I realize, you know, is not at all what the basis of the Democratic Party is, we need to be that left flank. We need to be the equivalent of those folks who are introducing the notion of privatizing Social Security, you know, 15 years ago, even when it polled abysmally, because that's what creates cover for the centrist to be like, well, you know, I mean, they're out there arguing for universal single payer. If we had had a credible voice arguing for universal single payer health care, then the public option would have appeared centrist. But instead, we had a debate, a mild debate between the public option and the mandate, which is what we have now.
Well, people did try and they got arrested going to the hearings in Washington.
Right, because we have a fundamental misunderstanding of how...
Doctors, I should say.
...public opinion is shaped. And we believe that the thing that we need to do is appear to be the reasonable adults in the room so that we can be invited into the room. That is a marked misunderstanding of how people actually make decisions. People make decisions based on context. There is no such thing as a middle. The middle is simply defined by what's on the left and right of it.
Anant Shankar Osorio is author of Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. And thank you for calling in, Lee. Let's go next to Larry in Pleasanton. Hi, Larry.
Oh, hi. I had a question about the word socialism. It seems like, I think socialism is a positive concept and a useful one. A lot of the things we're talking about, like Social Security or single-payer medical care, have socialist underpinnings. And I feel like if gay people can take back the word queer, then surely socialism can come back as a positive concept.
What do you think about the word socialism in that?
I mean, I have complete and total comfort with the word socialism. In sort of this space of language, you kind of want to think about which battles are worth fighting because you absolutely need to have them. So, for example, in the reproductive rights and health and justice debate, I would argue that we can't cede the word life. There is no equivalent, right? So that's a fight we're not willing. But the question becomes, is the retaking of socialism sort of worth it and does it get us enough? Interestingly, I believe that the phrase Social Security, and it's hard to hear this because Social Security has come to stand for a particular retirement program. But when you actually just listen to the words themselves, Social Security, it is one of the greatest phrases we could have ever come up with. So too, affirmative action. They're agentive, they're alliterative. You know, Social Security is sort of evokes kind of the most central concepts. You know, all you needed to get in there was freedom and you pretty much have kind of every positive thing, right? But what happens over time with repetition, and this goes back to your earlier question, Rose, about the echo chamber effect and Lee's question about, you know, how we get this right. If we don't sort of create an echo chamber, then we can actually take, you know, they can take over the meanings of words and they come to have a meaning. I remember very, very distinctly the first time I heard the phrase, I was coming home from the Peace Corps, war on terror. And it struck me as the strangest phrase in the entire world. And I thought, how is it that you could go to battle over an emotion? Next, we're going to have a war on anger. But as it was repeated over time, and granted, sometimes it was called war on terrorism, it came to have meaning. It came to make sense. And that is what we know about cognition, is that things can come to have meaning as they're socially constructed over time.
Well, thank you again for calling in, Larry. And speaking of the echo chamber, I was thinking about media, and Andy has a question about media in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Yeah, hi, Rose, and hi to your guest. Yeah, just real quick, you mentioned deficits. We talk about deficits, we should talk about trade deficits. Let's put it on trade. We have a huge trade deficit that's killing working people. And let's face it, the conversation here is about media and propaganda. And Edward L. Bernays and Joseph Goebbels knew that the most influential and important intermediary between a spiritual movement and the nation, between the idea and the people, is the media. And as long as the right wing owns the media, after the Telecommunications Act of 1996, massive consolidation, the plutocrats, the top 1%, just barrage us with their message over and over again, and it's against working people and for this really vicious capitalist system, and we lose. Until we change the media, until we break up these huge media conglomerates, we're going nowhere. Our message is going nowhere.
Well, thank you for that point, Andy. What are your thoughts on the media's role in all of this, Anat?
Yeah, Andy, I wish I could disagree. I like to call myself a pathological optimist, and so I always believe that, you know, it's going to be better, but I can't disagree with any of your points. I think that you hit right on a sort of central nerve that makes all of these other problems. But as far as the media, I mean, part of this, yes, is, you know, nefarious and is Fox News and is sort of Sean Hannity's deliberate, very, very well-crafted ideas and his colleagues to speak in a certain way in order to cloud the truth and make it easier to pass a right-wing agenda. But partly we're complicit in this as well because we have such a non-recognition. I mean, you hear the unemployment rate is rising on every channel. I haven't sort of monitored it, but I'm guessing it gets said at KLW. I'm guessing it gets said at KPFA. It is so the dominant way that we have come to understand discourse that until we become more disciplined about sort of what our language means and more importantly, what it conveys. And as far as propaganda, a thing that I want to point out that is usually really, really shocking to people, and this is just one example, in experiments in which people are primed unconsciously with numerical concepts and especially with sort of money-related concepts, so they're shown information about huge sums or about, you know, financial terms at a level they don't consciously register, so they don't know they've seen them. They become more selfish. Money-primed people are less likely to pick up pencils that the experimenter drops. Money-primed people will place chairs twice as far apart for a conversation they're told they're going to have than unprimed people. Money-primed undergrads want to be alone more of the time than their unprimed peers. So what is my point with this? Is this propaganda or is it a recognition of how the brain actually works? So every time one of us goes to have a debate about what we need to do to bolster Social Security or what we need to do to truly address the homeless problem, which is, you know, just it's an embarrassment. It's a shame. Mm-hmm. It is a black mark on our character and on ourselves as a nation. It's disgusting. But every time we go to have one of these conversations, we lead with what? 1.3 trillion and 2.7 billion and 6. Numbers that people can't understand. And we know from brain research that we are actually draining blood out of people, out of the emotional center of people's brains, sending it into the cerebral cortex and literally making it more difficult for people to have feelings.
What do you mean by money primed?
Money primed means that they've been given unconscious cues about either they've seen, I use the word loosely because they don't realize they've seen it, on a screen with a lot of other words that are visible. Behind them will be words associated with money.
Okay. You brought up a couple things there. Just quickly, what did your research find about how the public understands or does not understand basic functions of the economy?
Right. So, you know, it's a surprise to no one that the economy is largely seen as sort of this big, mysterious, confusing thing. And actually, that's a big, big part of the problem, that we are taught to believe and we have so little economic education beginning sort of at the primary school level and all the way up through even higher education. I was astounded to find, I don't remember the exact number anymore, that, you know, the abysmal percentage of folks in Congress who have even taken an economics course ever, including people on the Finance Committee. I mean, they basically just don't even know the thing on which they are operating. It would be like going to your gynecologist and having her talk to you about your muffler. I mean, it is frightening. So First, there is just this perception that the economy is so confusing and it's only for the experts and you need to have a gray beard and the letters DR or PhD after your name. So it is easier to sell people on this notion that, you know, they're there, little one. Let the experts, you know, let the bankers take care of it. They're the ones who understand this thing. Let the Fed do it. Let the, you know, the people who supposedly know what's going on, of course. So part of it is just there's an extreme amount of economic ignorance. But at the level at which I work, which is sort of unconscious conception, what I found was a range of metaphors for the economy, most often a defaulting to these organic metaphors, which is not surprising because those are dominant in our discourse that I referenced earlier, but a complete facility with usage of the economy as constructed object or more specifically a vehicle. People toggle in and out of these.
And Andy brought up media. I just was wondering, we're going to get one more call before we end. But before we do that, what's your experience been like doing interviews? What do you think about the questions that reporters or radio hosts are asking you?
Well, you know, present company, of course, excluded.
Of course.
Like I said, this is the dominant discourse. And so people don't even recognize it. It has become so sort of commonplace that they don't realize when they phrase their questions in these ways, they're already packing in an assumption about economic operation. And so a lot of my interviews end up being actually questions about the questions in which I'm sort of making the reporter's head spin by saying, did you notice how you just said this? Did you notice how you just said
that?
Can
you give us an example?
Sure. When they say to me, for example, what is your prescription for better economic health? Or, you know, what would you have us do to have the economy revive? And I say to them, you know, embedded within that question is the notion that the economy is an organic entity. What would it sound like if you had said, what could we do to get the economy moving forward? Or what do people need? What do Americans need in order to have greater personal security in a financial sense? That is a very, very different suggestion. Mm. And so what I often end up doing in these interviews, probably much to the consternation of the person with whom I'm speaking, is saying, don't you mean to ask me this?
Well, we have a couple more questions from listeners. Let's hear from Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's one of the best guests I ever had in your show, by the way. I really agree with her about most everything, and also the callers as well. Media, it could be called media weapon deception more than anything else. I'd like to say a very important thing that people don't realize. The United States as a whole is richer than ever. It's just the money shifted upward so high. Mm. Not only that, but banks and the whole organization that holds the money, they are not recycling it at all. And that whole, it really makes me very angry when I hear Obama not only getting one Wall Street man after another, after another, after another, but when he used the word austerity, I shake in my foot, because what happened to this country is the greatest highway robbery ever in history by the Wall Street. The United States is rich, the money is there, nationalized bank, give back the money to the people, put the money in the system, spend far more money. Your guest, Krugman and Robert Reich, as the only decent economists in the whole country, all of the other people of Heskin School or the Harvard, the rest of economists should really go away.
Thank you, Eid. And you know, Eid's frustration, you can feel it, and a lot of people feel this. In fact, the Washington Post had a story yesterday that is called Treasury Approved Excessive Pay for Executives at Bailed Out AIG and General Motors. So it's about these executives who got bailouts, who got between $100,000 and $1 million in raises, and this was approved by the Treasury Department. And people just hit their heads on the wall and say, what?
Yeah.
How do we counter this? What do we do about this?
Well, I mean, part of it, and Eid did it beautifully, I don't really know that I could do it any better, is to actually express our outrage and to express in really plain terms what is happening. As I said before, people do not lose their houses. The unemployment rate does not self-levitate. The economy did not, you know, make itself sick. It didn't catch some sort of virus, and if we just wait, it's going to get better if we just give it plenty of fluids and rest. Some idiots knowingly crashed it hard against the wall. And all we have done until today is done some work fixing that car. We haven't done anything about the collateral damage, because when it made that crash, it pretty much knocked out most of us, right?
So we've got about 2 minutes left. We don't have time to take your call, Charlie. He wanted to know if the model that you talk about is working somewhere at a local level, for example.
Yeah, it's a great question. So if you look at sort of the more promising discourse, and, you know, the previous caller brought up Krugman and Reich, and I would add to that Joe Stiglitz and Galbraith down in Texas, they are much, much more akin. They are much more likely to use these mechanistic models. And in local contexts, if you read carefully on sort of cooperative websites, they too are referencing the economy in these terms intuitively.
And a minute and a half, what would you like to see change? I mean, are you using words that you'd like to see change that would actually shift the conversation? I mean, where do we go from here at a time when, face it, the next few months are going to be about Social Security and retirement?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously the solution to Social Security, and we all know it, is just to simply lift the cap. It is a no-brainer. And I think that, you know, in a minute and a half, I would say, don't say unemployed, say jobless. Make sure that all of your sentences are in what I like to call the people do things construction. Does your sentence indicate that a person did a thing, not that a thing just happened? And that's sort of the best off-the-cuff advice I can give with
It is really, though, fascinating when you talk about the fact that people are often missing from these conversations.
Yeah.
And I don't think most people even realize that.
Right. Because it washes over us.
Are you getting a good response? Are you finding that organizations are trying to change their wording on these issues?
Yeah. No, I'm finding quite a bit. On my website, there's what I like to call a cheat sheet that's just a one-pager of, you know, instead of saying this, say that. And so there's been a lot of switch over to that. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, this comfort with being the left flank and this comfort with finding messages that actually alienate the opposition purposely is difficult for us as progressives. We just want everyone to like us.
Well, we will have to definitely continue this conversation. Anat Shankar Osorio is author of the book, Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. You can find more about her work at yourcallradio.org. Anat, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for your phone calls. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How do you balance natural and technological ways of living? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Nathaniel Johnson, author of All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover if the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment really keeps us healthier and happier. He says some are drawn to natural solutions and organic lifestyles, while others rally around high-tech development and industrial efficiencies. Which have you chosen, and have you been able to find a happy medium? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.